This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. It was just about this time, on this date in 1877, that the first national strike started, and it started in Baltimore. 24 locomotive firemen employed by the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad refused to man the trains at the Camden Yard, Mount Clair, and Riverside stations. Within hours, the work stoppage had spread to Martinsburg, West Virginia, then to other states. Within a week, almost half the U.S. Army was deployed against more than 100,000 strikers. And before the strike collapsed 2 weeks later, 10 citizens had been killed in Baltimore alone. Bill Berry, retired director of labor studies at the Community College of Baltimore County, Dundalk, has just published a book about it, The 1877 Railroad Strike in Baltimore. And he's here in the studio to talk about it. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Sheila.
Really exciting narrative. I'm really glad you're here to tell us. You give us a lot of context in this book. First, let's talk about the workers, mostly Irish immigrants, right?
Many of them were. And one of the things that I've said before is that this is really 10 books in one. It's a history of the immigrant community. It's a history of the railroad industry, the B&O. But many of the workers were immigrants. The first wave of Irish immigrants came and built the railroads. And they had their own labor disputes with the contractors, and these were men who moved their families along as the railroad went west. But then the men who operated the trains, and the strike was really against the freight railroads, not against the passenger lines. And it was a response to a second wage cut.
And I want to ask you about that, but as background, you walk us through more than a half dozen different job classifications.
Yes.
You tell us about the conductors,
the
locomotive
the
engineers,
and
the firemen, the brakemen, the switchers. And then you describe the rise of the industrial union. Tell us the significance of that.
Well, one of the things that happened, and I think it's important for workers today, and as we look at how workers today are trying to deal with a global economy, it really has changed how workers organize changes. And what we see here in Baltimore, that there were two other strikes, one by the can makers and the other one by some box makers. And these were the workshops. These were small, individually owned back alleys, 10 people, 11 people on strike at the same time. The railroads were the first national industry. And they'd been organized by the craft unions, with each skilled trade, the engineers, the conductors, the brakemen, represented by a separate union. But just at that time, a group in Pennsylvania started to organize a trainmen's union, which is what we would call an industrial union, in which all workers from a common employer were represented by one union. And the trainmen had the idea that individual crafts would work when other ones were on strike, and it was not an effective way to deal with a huge economic enterprise like the B&O or railroads generally.
And so one more piece of context before I ask you what triggered the strike. You draw a more or less a through line between what's known as the Panic of 1873, a national recession, and the strike in 1877. What were the economic pressures on the railroad and on the workers?
Well, the same pressures that we are seeing today. And as I said, part of the book was written as an illustration for people today who are dealing with the consequences of an economic recession or depression. And what happened in the Panic of 1873 is collapse of a lot of enterprises, speculation, a little bit more familiar with people who are looking at 1929. But the railroads uses an opportunity, as did many industries, to cut wages. And in 1876, in November, the B&O cut 10% wages. Their company records show that their financial position improved as a result of the wage cut. So the B&O was not only not losing money, they were making more money. And what happens in the second week of June of 1877 is that the board of directors very routinely passes yet another 10%.
And in the reduction in wages.
Between the first cut, they began to eliminate what they called deadheads, that is, trainmen would be assigned a run to Cumberland, for example. And then instead of being able to come back for free, they were required to pay their way back or to pay to stay overnight in Cumberland, pay for meals and a hotel before they would catch a paid assignment from the B&O back to Baltimore.
That, of course, ate into their wages.
Sure, of course. And in fact, one of the problems was as the pay cuts were entertained, work weeks were cut, men started having their paychecks attached, and the B&O create a policy that if your paycheck were attached for debts, you would be fired. And so just at the time when the guys needed the jobs most of all, the companies cut them. And it was funny because in the minutes of the trustees meeting of June 10th,
the B&O Railroad.
John Garrett was there. They routinely passed another 10% wage cut. They said, we hope that everyone will concur cordially with it. And they were so confident that the workers would take it that they said that since everybody was on vacation in August, they weren't going to have another meeting until September. 4 days later, John Garrett was on the telegraph to the President of the United States saying, send me some troops.
That's Bill Berry here on WYPR Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. He's retired director of labor studies at CCBC Dundalk. And we're talking about his new book, which he'll be speaking about tomorrow night at Red Emma's, The 1877 Railroad Strike in Baltimore. Okay, you've taken us into the strike. Back up a couple days. July 16th. 1877, 137 years ago today, what happened?
Well, a group of men did not cheerfully concur, as John Garrett had hoped, and they went down to the main area of the Camden Yards and said, we're not going to work for that 10% cut. And it then spread to other stations here in Baltimore City. It quickly spread up and down the line. They went out, for example, to Relay, which was halfway to Ellicott City. Stopped a train out there. The guys got off the train and stranded everybody in the middle of Howard County. It then
stranded everybody, but you said these were freight trains, not passenger trains.
Yeah, right, but I mean, it left the freight right there. Oh. And often, as the strike went on, the workers would uncouple the cars and move them onto a siding. At some points, they would actually take cattle off the cars and put them out to graze. The workers were very protective of the railroad property, and they were maliciously attacked during the strike as being communists and destroyers, but they had a very careful plan to maintain the stock of the railroads. So the strike then spread to Martinsburg, which was a central hub for the B&O. By the end of the day, large crowds had gathered out there. The governor of West Virginia then contacted John Garrett and went back and forth.
John Garrett, the head of
the B&O. And they then contacted the National Guard in West Virginia to call that out. And by Wednesday, when it was very clear that the National Guard wasn't going to be sufficient, because many of the guardsmen were railroad workers, friends of railroad workers, and certainly sympathetic. And so they then called on federal troops.
Describe the violence.
The violence was often described as being only on the part of the strikers. But in fact, what we see on Friday of the strike...
This is what date?
The 21st. 20th, rather. Two companies of militia were ordered out by the governor of Maryland to be sent to Cumberland. And they were marshaled at their armories. One was on Reed Street and Howard Street. And the other one was at an armory over by what is now the Shot Tower and the main post office out in East Baltimore. And the group from Reed Street marched down the street arm in arm, weapons drawn, and were able to get through the crowds of supporters. The group from East...
Crowds of strike supporters.
Yes. The families were out. One of the things that was important during the strike was huge numbers of unemployed workers. And they were slurred by the newspapers as tramps. But as we saw, certainly in the 1930s, lots of men riding the rails looking for work. I mean, it was an economic crisis. And so the group in East Baltimore was yelled at, and people threw some bricks, and they started to march out, and it was a small stairway. They could only come down two at a time, and one of the young soldiers was so eager to get back in the building that he was almost bayoneted by the soldier behind him. It was a very dramatic scene. So they start marching, and at some point over by what is now City Hall, or was then City Hall, some of the soldiers start shooting, and they kill 10 people, including a 14-year-old newsboy. And none of the people killed were involved in the strike at all. In fact, a couple of them were, one man had just said, oh, let's get out of here, and then he was killed.
Was there that kind of violence elsewhere in the strike?
There was different kinds, yes. For example, in Pittsburgh, on Saturday night, the militia was brought in from Philadelphia because the Pittsburgh militia was not trustworthy, and the strikers got them into the roundhouse in Pittsburgh, the B&O roundhouse, into the Pennsylvania Railroad roundhouse, and took some oil cars and set them on fire and pushed them into the roundhouse. So there was a lot of activity in all areas.
So this strike was not just against the B&O.
It was against all the railroads. And you will see it spreading. It started in Baltimore, went to Martinsburg. Big cities like Chicago, St. Louis had a general strike. San Francisco had groups of men roaming the streets, burning the Chinese community. I mean, it was an excuse for anti-immigrant activity. So in the large railheads, obviously Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Chicago, St. Louis, San Francisco, but in small railheads, and dozens of railroads were on strike, and literally hundreds of other workers saw this kinds of activity. And I even have an example of newsboys in Detroit struck because they want another half cent per paper. And by the third edition, some of them were sneaking in and taking the papers and breaking the strike. So it was an enormously explosive period.
How did it end? And when did it end?
Badly. It ended over the next 3 or 4 weeks. Baltimore, by the end of the week, was under total military control.
Was there a formal end to the strike?
No. It kind of just dribbled away.
And the strikers just gave up?
Yes.
Did they get anything that they were seeking?
Not immediately. Shortly afterward, the beginning of the next year, the B&O instituted a pension plan. And over the next 35 or 40 years, railroad workers generally were the first ones to get collective bargaining. And there was a series of strikes in the 1880s under the Knights of Labor. But overall, the railroad workers long term gained union recognition that a lot of other industries didn't have.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Bill Berry, retired director of labor studies at the Community College of Baltimore County, Dundalk. His new book is The 1877 Railroad Strike in Baltimore. He's speaking about it tomorrow evening, 7:30 p.m., at Red Emma's on North Avenue. We've got information about that and about the book on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also there, more of Bill Berry's reflections on the impact of the strike. I'm Sheila Cass. After a break on Maryland Morning, getting art out there. Stay with us on 88.1.